Sitting next to me is Simon Brannigan from the Marine Restoration Coordinator from the Nature Conservancy. Good morning.
Good morning.
Last year, Max Allen and I had a little conversation here called The True Story of Oysters and Champagne. And we sat people down with a glass of French champagne and then we told the most horrendous story of environmental destruction. The story from Noosa to Perth. There were once thousands of oyster beds, reefs, Angazi native oysters, and these were the rainforests of the sea. They extended, dotted across the coast, underwater, these amazing places where fish bred, where they swam, safe places. Oysters, mussels, underwater, scores of different species living together to create this ecosystem, incredibly diverse. They filtered the water. They could filter tons of water a day from being murky to pure water to really clear water. Come colonisation, it's a good source of protein. 1835, Melbourne settled. 1841, the first law goes out banning the Bunurong women from harvesting them because they're so important to the food industry and the building industry. The shells were ground for lime to make the mortar. By 1890, it was too late. The laws that were put in place around Melbourne and Western Port to stop the dredging of these reefs was too late. They had already gone. Within 40 years of settlement of Victoria and around the coast, this natural resource, this amazing, the rainforests of under the sea had gone. They have actually been lost from our memory. We don't know about them because they've been gone so long because that first encounter with them was so destructive. We don't have language for them. We don't know them. There's only one left in the east coast of Tasmania. But that story is about to change. Simon, tell me about what do you guys do.
I think we need some good news after that. So, like I said, I work for the Nature Conservancy. So since 2014, we've been embarking on a mission to rebuild these shellfish reefs. So Port Phillip Bay was the first shellfish reef in Australia that was restored. We've restored around a MCG size of reefs, being Victoria. I need to talk in MCG style terms. So yeah, essentially we've restored two large reefs in Hobson's Bay off St Kilda and also four reefs in Geelong, oyster reefs and mussel reefs. Port Phillip Bay was once dominated by shellfish reefs. Up to 50% of the seafloor was once dominated by shellfish reefs or oyster reefs.
Tell me what. So when you say shellfish, describe the fish we're talking about.
So if you can imagine a coral reef, you're snorkeling over a coral reef, the dominant feature is coral, whereas on an oyster reef, the dominant feature is either oysters or mussels. Three-dimensional structures that come off from the seabed, but it's a living, breathing reef. There's kelp, there's encrusting coralline algae, there's a bunch of other species as well, but the dominant feature will be the Angazi oysters, all the blue mussels, or you head up north, the Sydney rock oyster.
So the Angazi oyster, if anyone's from Melbourne, they're the oyster, the big flat oyster shell that you see around Brighton Beach, etc.
Yeah, that's right. That's okay.
And are they the remnants of those old reefs, are they?
Yeah, so the areas within Port Phillip Bay where we're building reefs are an old, largely dead and buried reefs.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we've had a lot of success bringing them back. It's really exciting.
Okay, so hang on, bring them back. So how do you build a reef?
So it's reconstruction. So first of all, we need to build a reef base. We use a combination of limestone rubble and recycled shell. We recycle shells from seafood wholesalers, restaurants in Melbourne and Geelong, and also at festivals, the Port Arlington Mussel Festival. We actually was recycling the shells yesterday at the festival here. We cure those shells for up to 6 months, then we put them back. We basically build a reef base, then we sprinkle oysters or mussels over top of that reef base. And the oysters and mussels are different from the abalone and scallop shells, whereas the oysters and mussels, they cement together and they grow on top of each other and they increase in size over time.
Hang on a minute. So you've got in these oysters. So let's go back. How did this whole concept start of actually rebuilding reefs? Because this sounds like a lot of people involved. You've got restaurants. You've got dredgers. You've got barges going out. They're dropping rock into the water. How does this concept start?
The concept started around 20 years ago in the US. I like to say I invented this, but I didn't. So they've been restoring reefs in the US for around 20 years. We've imported it to Australia and tailoring it to local conditions, working with scientists that I work with, universities, Seafood Industry Victoria, VR Fish, divers, boaters, marine care groups. It's a collaborative effort to bring back these reefs over time.
So I'll just involve the audience for a second, because I just want to see the awareness of the Angazi oyster. Who knows about their native Angazi oyster, the oyster that's native to Victoria? Who knows about that? Okay, there's no shame here. Who doesn't know about the Angazi oyster? Okay, let's just go back. I just need to do a bit of groundwork here. Let's go back. Anyone from Melbourne or anyone from coastal Victoria? Have you seen the large flat shells on the beach? They are the ghosts of these reefs. The reefs have gone and these are the ghosts. All right? They were everywhere in the bay. From, you can go to Port Albert, you can go to Lake's Entrance, you can go to Mallacoota, and you'll hear stories of the old fishermen talking about these reefs. So they're the ones we're talking about. The other species is the mussel. Which one is it?
Yeah, blue mussel.
But that's okay. So the blue mussel. These are the ones if we go down to Port Arlington,
yeah,
or Flinders.
That's right.
They're now involved in aquaculture.
Yeah, the aquaculture industry grow the
ropes.
Blue the mussel, and they also grow a small amount of Angazi oysters as well, the flat oysters for market.
Okay, and so you'll bring these species that are native to these areas and bring them back. So you're constructing these reefs and bringing them back.
That's right.
Okay, cool. So it seems a lot of work. What's the benefit to, let's say, for the bay to begin with?
I guess you look at Port Phillip Bay, it's in pretty good condition, but it could be in a lot more healthier condition. One oyster, for example, can filter around a bathtub of water per day. A hectare of...
Not after I've beaten it, mate.
A hectare of restored shellfish reefs can produce around 375 kilos of new fish into the system every year. So when you start looking at 10 hectares, 20 hectares, 30 hectares, there's both a benefit around the water quality in the bay and also around the health of the ecosystem, and more fish is an example of that.
So if we go around the bay and you'll hear about midden sites around, say, Western Port Bay, Port Phillip Bay, and all around the coast of Australia, midden sites. You'll find different sorts of shellfish from abalone and the black-lipped mussel. Is it what's it called?
Blue mussel.
Yeah. But the ones that are most endurable are the Angazi oysters.
That's right.
And these are what these are. 10,000-year-old middens we find. And so it's also that cultural connection you're bringing back as well. So we're talking about the health of the bay, we're talking about the cultural connection. Okay, I'm a landlubber. I don't go anywhere near the water. You're spending all this taxpayers' money. What's the benefit to me?
Well, the benefits for all Victorians, really. So, I mean, it's not only about Port Phillip Bay. It's Western Port, it's Corner Inlet, it's Mallacoola Inlet, Gippsland Lakes. Coming down the southwest, we don't know much about the shellfish reefs down here. So I guess the benefit is a healthy, thriving ecosystem and the industries that rely on that healthy ecosystem. So be it commercial fishers, recreational fishers, boaters, divers, snorkelers.
Marcus, you'll be interested in this. So you took the Minister for Fisheries, Yala Pulford,
yes.
Down and you took her underwater.
Yes.
Okay, and so you put a mask on her, I hope, and a breathing apparatus.
Yep,
okay,
yep,
thank
yep,
you.
Yep.
And you sent her on a static line. She went down underwater, about how many metres?
At Margaret's Reef, which is in Hobson's Bay off St Kilda, it's just under 10 metres.
Okay, 10 metres. What did she see there?
Unfortunately, the visibility wasn't great.
Pretend the visibility is magnificent
but
for the sake of the story.
What she did see, so basically we put a shot line on the reef with a float, we descended down, and straight away there was over 1,000-plus two-year-old pinky snapper. So it was incredible. So this reef, from 3 years ago, there was pretty much nothing there. Now it's like just flocking with different types of fish species. Is incredible. So right on cue, there were the fish.
So we've got, what other species of fish hang around these reefs?
There was some mentioned today. So we have wrasse, flathead. We've got the smaller cryptic species like hula fish and pygmy leather jacket. Then we've got the invertebrates like the snapping shrimp. So there's a range of different species that are relying on this reef as habitat. It's a real sort of nursery ground. So if you can imagine at the moment in St Kilda, we have two reefs. If you can expand that footprint out on the hectare scale, you're going to see some big differences.
This sounds fascinating. Now, can we get any... Can I dive on these reefs?
Sure can.
Okay. That sounds absolutely brilliant. So, but hang on. So you're a conservancy mob. So you'd be... How do you work with the local fishing industry?
So we work with the Victorian Shellfish Hatchery. The hatchery grow the oysters or mussels that we see the reef with. We also work with aquaculture farmers out in the bay. We purchase mussels off them to put on the reef.
How do you actually do that? So how do we actually put the oysters and the mussels onto the reef? You don't like...
We invented a contraption, what we call the bivalve blaster. It's the best name I've come up so far. It's like a...
The bivalve blaster 2000.
It's like a reverse vacuum cleaner. Essentially, you've got like a... you're up on a punt. You have like a box up here. You put the oysters or mussels in at the top. It goes down a pipe and you have a commercial diver that's sort of sprinkling the oysters and mussels over the reef base like icing on a cake. Those oysters or mussels will then attach to the shells and limestone, reach sexual maturity, spawn, the larvae grow on top of each other and the reef will increase in size.
Putting this together and with the conversation with Bren Smith, there's a couple of confluences there. He's talking if we don't do anything with the oceans, they're going to die because we've had so much human interference. And it sounds like if... is that the same situation with our coastal waterways as well?
Yeah, I mean, it's dead right. There's been land care for years. There's been a lot of restoration on land. There's been a lot less detention on our bays and estuaries. No matter what we do, no matter how much we improve the catchment of coast processes, there's some habitats that just aren't going to come back, be that shellfish reefs, seagrass, kelp. You certainly need active intervention in our waters to create a healthy environment. And the green wave example around multi-species aquaculture farming is one way you could do it, and that's really exciting.
So actually we're moving away from preservation and conservation to real strong human intervention.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there's plenty of evidence that on land that the benefits of putting back a diverse amount of species in an area that was previously cleared, so we certainly need to do it in the water as well.
That's a bit of a... That's not only a wake-up call, that's like a tap on the shoulder, isn't it?
That's right.
Oh, okay. That is, like, Simon, that is fascinating, and thank you for your time. Can you thank Simon?
Yeah. Thank you.
Just hang in there. If we want to get in... what are your details? Where do we look for your work?
The easiest would be to Google natureaustralia.org. That's our website, and you can find contact details for me on there.
Or head out in the tinny with the scuba gear.
So Clifton Springs Boat Ramp. You can head out on the other side of the shipping channel towards the Yuyangs. That's where the reefs are.
Yep.
And if anyone's had the pleasure of going to the Albert Park Yachting and Angling Club in Melbourne, the reefs are sort of offshore from there. But beyond Victoria, we're looking at restoring reefs in Tasmania, New South Wales and Queensland as well. So there's active conservations happening in those regions as well.
Oh, thank you so much for doing some hard work in the waterways. Speaking about hard work in the waterways, we've got a bit of interest in the Bass Strait. There's some big boats coming around. They're doing a little bit of work. They're having a bit of a look around. Lisa Depley, you're a local activist for Fight for the Bite. Can you just inform us what's going on with the interest out in the bite? I'll leave it up to you.
Okay. There's basically three things out there that are disturbing at the moment.
Yeah.
In the Great Australian Bite. We've got Equinor, which is a Norwegian oil company that has just been given the latest go-ahead from NOPSEMA, which is our national regulator. They passed their environmental plan on the 18th of December, just before Christmas, like they like to do.
What do they do? What do they do?
NOPSEMA?
Yeah, what do they do?
NOPSEMA are, I think they're like a statutory authority, like of the Commonwealth Government.
Okay.
And they are a regulator. NOPSEMA stands for, Marcus, you're going to help me out here. It's National Offshore Petroleum.
We always say small E because they don't really take it seriously.
Environmental.
Okay, so we're now talking about petroleum. And who's hunting around for petroleum? What's the name again?
At this stage, it's Equinor.
Yeah.
So previously, we had BP and Chevron.
Yep.
wanted to put in some oil wells out there. Very deep sea, high risk, a really rough part of the Great Australian Bight, 400 kilometres basically off the Nullarbor coast. They pulled out Chevron and BP because there was just a lot of pressure from the people of Australia, the communities basically along the south of Australia. I think 30 local councils formally disapproved to them having their development out there.
Was that because Chevron and BP have retail exposure here in Australia and they were worried about social licence?
Yeah, maybe.
And so the Norwegian company, they don't have any retail out there. They're simply a miner. They don't have any retail exposure here in Australia.
They do have a couple of other things going on in Australia. But most of their... they've got two leases out there or two exploration permits. It's pretty dangerous stuff. If they have a blowout of their exploration drill, it's known there's been studies done by BP who went there before and pulled out that the oil could spill as far as southern New South Wales and Esperance off Western Australia. So I think they bragged that their the new development would employ 1,500 people. It's not a patch to how many people are employed along here in restaurants, fishing industry and tourism.
So it's not just the well you're concerned about, is that the process of exploration?
Sorry?
Is actually the process of exploration you're concerned about as well?
Oh, yes. That's another issue. It's already been seismic tested, so they've got a bit of an idea what's down there. Seismic testing, I don't know if anybody heard me spruiking yesterday down at the seafood festival. Basically, they send a boat out, a survey vessel. There's one at the moment on the Otway Basin, which is southwest of here, out from Portland. And... they're letting off 259 decibel blasts every 10 seconds, every day, 7 days a week, for 3 months straight. There hasn't been a real lot of scientific research into the effect of seismic blasting, but we know it. We know it kills zooplankton for 1.5 kilometres radius of each blast. We know it can kill scallops. I'm sure it has a bad effect on oysters. And I believe it affects the immune system of crayfish. A lot of the studies, though, that have been done have been paid for by gas and oil companies, so they're often a bit skewed.
And you had another concern that said there's other couple of concerns going on in the Bight as well.
Oh, okay. So that's the Commonwealth water that we're talking about out there. The Victorian state government. Also, they own 3 nautical miles from the beach out, or they manage. Now, our Victorian government last year released a 3 nautical mile corridor from Port Campbell all the way to the South Australian border. For exploration and seismic testing. Now, seismic testing is so much worse when the water's shallow. Also, your beaches or those rock areas, they're higher in biodiversity. They're nurseries for a lot of our critters. It's probably the craziest thing I've heard, and it's very upsetting. The Victorian government's gone a bit quiet on it. We're not too sure where it's at the moment, but they had submissions. You can Google it, but submissions have closed for those people that would be interested in those tenders, those exploration tenders.
That sounds like bang your head against the table sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty crazy. We've got people doing great stuff like Bren and Simon, and in the meantime, we're not looking after the good shit, you know? We're destroying... It's easier to look after the good than try and recreate it, because you can never recreate it like it used to be. It's madness out there. Like, we don't need any more oil, gas. We've already got 5 times more than what we need to take us to a 2-degree temperature increase. So we're out there killing stuff, and we don't even know how much we're killing out there. They don't know. It's like shooting a gun into a dark room, and you really don't know how much damage you're doing. And we're doing that when we're killing things when we don't need to. It's a money thing. It's Matt Canavan. It's Noxzema. Frosty was telling me that it takes 5 years. He's fished reefs that before and after, and they take 5 years to recover before he can catch cray off those reefs again.
Lisa, we've got a good break for lunch. We've got a few lot of things to do. How do people get in contact with Fight for the Bite? Have you got a flyer or something if people are interested in working with you?
No, I don't.
What sort of bloody activist are you? there was so much interest yesterday down the harbour.
You
handed them all out yesterday.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So what's your website?
We haven't got a website yet. This is pretty new, Ocean. Otway, what is it? Climate Emergency Action Network. And we are very much, we're a little bit sick and tired of signing petitions and marching. We're actually intend to be quite active.
Lisa, you're going to be hanging around lunchtime.
Yeah.
Can you please do that? And if anyone wants to speak to you and form a posse,
we definitely need new members and lots of support.
Okay, Lisa, thank you very much.
Thank you. Hang
around. Thanks. It's great. As again, leadership. People getting up and a room of leaders.
I love this. It's very powerful, isn't it? Empowering. Yeah, taking it all into our own hands.
Hey, do you want to run questions? We've got 10 minutes of questions.
Yes, we've got 10 minutes of questions.
And as Matthew, you're in the room still, are you? Matthew Evans, you're still here.
Yes.
And our chef's still here. Jono Davies is still here.
Yes.
You lead the questions and I'll be the roving mic.
Okay, who has... here we have one question for this lady.
We use a microphone that goes on the podcast.
So as the ocean warms up, how do the reefs that
Is this for Simon?
Yeah, for Simon.
Simon, question.
How do the oyster and mussel reefs that you're creating, how are they affected?
That's a really good question. So I guess with the oyster reefs, there is a calcium content in the shell. So we do think that will weaken over time. How much of that will weaken, we're not exactly sure. But The oysters and mussels have been around for thousands of years, so we do sort of think that they will adapt. There has been some work done on the Sydney rock oysters up north to see around the impacts of that, and they did see a thinning of the shell, but the oysters still persisted. So time will tell, but I do have some confidence that there's enough resilience in that system that they'll be able to cope with that change over time, particularly the oysters over the mussels.
Next question. And please, when you do ask a question, can you say who you are and where you're... tell us your name and tell us where you're from. Thank you. But this guy here,
Bill,
we don't trust him.
Just following on that, where do we get these oysters if we want to eat them now?
Listen, another really good question. There's not a lot that are getting grown locally in Victoria at the moment, and I know that Jonathan and I would like to sort of change that, and we're working towards changing that. They're growing the Angazi flat oysters in Tasmania. There's some juices down there, also northern New South Wales. You have to look around a little bit. So you can source them. I think they're kind of like the craft beer or the red wine oyster. I reckon they're beautiful.
That's wonderful. Okay, next question. Question for Jonathan or Matthew? Oh, yes. Bring it on. Bring it on.
So,
what's your name and where
really
are you
quickly,
from?
So, just in terms of from a seafood industry's perspective, we've got people who are ready to put money in on the ground to start growing oysters in Victoria. We've got these guys who from the Nature Conservancy who have shown us how to do it. We know that they're already native, but through climate change, through other environmental forces, they're no longer there at the moment. We've got bays and inlets that are ready to start farming, improving water quality, etc. Again, it comes back to the whole policy commitment. There is no definition from a political perspective about how we start to grow aquaculture. What does harvest and culture look like into the future? So I think that's a discussion that we're having. that we need to have, and we need to have a mature discussion about it in terms of future growth and opportunity.
Should we have a break now, I think?
I think it's about time for lunch, yeah.
I think we should go and have lunch. And we're regrouping here.
Regrouping here. What time, Liz, are we back?
1:30. 1:20. Come back, start heading back around 1:20.
1:20 back in the room. Thank you very much.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you for a great morning. Guess what he told me.